When I was sitting sesshin with a Zen teacher, Zen master in Japan, for that one particular retreat, I was seated right next to him in the meditation hall. So he was sitting right here. And when I fell asleep, he would tug my sleeve. And it was a very compassionate thing to do. And so I noticed a number of people actually today were falling asleep here. And I don't know if it's sort of leftover from the time change last week or I don't know what, but it's actually kind of can be a very compassionate thing to do, to just kind of tap someone on their knee or on their shoulder, the person's next to you. And generally, when someone falls asleep, I think my reaction is usually I either feel happy for the person or it arouses compassion. And so it happens to all of us. It's happened to me even sitting up here. But no one has tapped me. So as many of you know, the issue of self, selfing, self-identity, self-concept is a very important one in Buddhist practice, and somehow coming to terms with it. And today I want to take one particular aspect of selfing, of this area of self, and that is the topic of conceit. And conceit, in English, as I understand it, usually means that a person feels superior to others, better than others. And in Buddhist language, the word mana, often translated as conceit, has the meaning of any kind of comparisons. So we're comparing ourselves to others. So it includes both considering yourself superior to others, but it also includes considering yourself to be inferior to others. And also, oddly enough, it also means when you consider yourself equal to others. So what's left? And it's sometimes pointed out that occasionally people who have very low self-esteem, very shy, for example, there's actually a very strong ego there. It's that strong ego has latched on to being inferior in some way, and it's a little bit counterintuitive. We think of someone with low self-esteem doesn't have much ego, but occasionally, sometimes it's actually a case that the person, a very shy person, actually has a very strong ego, but it takes the form of being afraid in some way. So there's these three different forms, and for some people, maybe most of us, all three are operating, sometimes simultaneously or within minutes of each other. So some people have one as a predominant characteristics of themselves, but we can be all over that spectrum at different times. And that's certainly been my case in my life, and certainly in engaging in Buddhist practice, that I've had to contend with being on all the full range of that spectrum. Sometimes I've had to deal with conceit where I felt I was somehow inferior, sometimes superior, and sometimes the whole issue of equality was a big place where I got caught. So what I thought I'd do today is to tell you some stories about my own negotiation of this and how it's, they all came into play at different times, and maybe that's interesting for you. One of the things, as you listen to this, you might notice, or I'd like you to notice, is that most of these stories have nothing to do with meditation. And here, we're a meditation tradition here, and we think of meditation as where a lot of transformation is going to happen. But these stories in my time in Buddhist practice are not explicitly about meditation. So what's that about? And so that I'll leave that as a question mark for you for the time being, and the mystery of the talk, and keep you on the edge of your seats until the end of the talk. So in a sense, before talking about stories of conceit, I'd like to tell you one of my favorite stories from my practice life. I've often mentioned it here, and that is when I was first a Zen student. So my early time beginning practice of Zen, and I had a hallucination. And I'm not prone to hallucination, but it's one of those rare ones that I somehow occurred. And I was doing Zen practice in a small Zen sitting group in a bedroom in Davis, California. I mean, the bedroom was transformed into a little place, a little zendo. And because it was a small place, we sat facing, in the tradition, we sat facing the wall with the eyes open. And but because it was such a small room, my knees were basically almost touching the wall because it was so small. So the wall was right here. And I sat down to meditate, and as soon as I started meditating, this massive Roman column rose up in front of me with great authority and stature and the kind of thing you can really trust because, you know, your money is kept in that kind of bank, you know. And written down the column were the letters engraved, painted black, were the letters Z-E-N. And then, you know, I don't know where the hallucination stopped and where reality kicked in, but this is kind of the way I experienced it. I went to embrace this column. And as I embraced it, it vanished. And I fell forward and my head hit the wall. So that got my attention. And what I did with that little experience was that I interpreted a meaning that I had taken Zen as being this great authoritative, you know, religion that was external to me, that I had to somehow embrace it and become it or learn from it. Something external to me. I had to read all these books about Zen or something and make myself into Zen or hold on to it. And Zen vanished when I tried to grab it. In a sense, Zen or Buddhism doesn't exist. So if you try to grab it the wrong way, there's nothing there for you. And then I realized, well, you know, studying Zen or studying Buddhism is not about Zen or Buddhism, it's about me. Just to understand myself, to understand what's going on here to a great extent. So then, you know, a lot of things, you know, that happened over the many years of practice had to do with a sense of self, understanding it and seeing how it operated. A year or so after this experience, I started going a lot to the San Francisco Zen Center, visiting there. And one of the very powerful first experiences there was that I would go there and try to present myself in a particular way. I would say things to the people there that were not just neutral pieces of information, but as for many people, when we talk about, we say things, often our saying, our conversational talking, we're trying to accomplish something, do something. We're trying to make ourselves safe, or get people to see us a certain way, to build ourselves up, or to hide ourselves, or, you know, there's often a lot of selfing involved in conversation. So I was playing various games like that. Mostly I wanted people to think that I was great. And so I would say something. And the amazing thing that happened was that many of the kind of senior students there, they wouldn't respond. And, you know, it was kind of like, again, this feeling of, you know, nothing there. But more importantly, it was like a mirror. Because there was no response, I was left kind of hanging in the air. Wow, you know. And I got to see what I was trying to do in a way that when people participated in that whole selfing game or kind of they were playing it also and bouncing off that me with my idea of self, with their idea of self, and, you know, you don't really see it so clearly. But because it wasn't reciprocated, I saw it really clearly, and I felt that really great. I loved it. And it's one of the reasons why I decided to go to Zen Center, because to go live there, because I wanted to be around people who weren't going to let me play my games, my selfing games. I found out many years later that it wasn't necessarily that they were wise, they were just aloof. But it worked for me. And then there were certainly times in my early practice where I thought I was a great meditator. You know, God's gift to meditation. And not so dramatic, but anyway, I thought my meditation was pretty good. And so there was a certain conceit around that. And then I would sit for retreats, and it became very clear by the second or third day that how terrible I was as a meditator. You know, I couldn't get concentrated at all. And in fact, the very conceit of being a good meditator was one of the obstacles to being able to meditate well. Isn't that something? So I had to deal with that pain, that frustration, and eventually I had to see the conceit I had. And I had to learn to, you know, I was humbled and had to let go of it, not hold on to it. Remember also that before I was a teacher, a Buddhist teacher, there were times when I gave brilliant Dharma talks in my head. And in some ways, the newer student I was, the more brilliant were my Dharma talks. You know, in my analysis, you know, I'd be sitting or listening to someone giving a Dharma talk, and I would start going off on how I'd do a much better job, and I'd go off and I'd lose touch with the Dharma talk that was being given because I was giving my own, and a certain conceit around that. And I wonder how many of you are listening to me. And it was very humbling when I actually started having to give talks, and I was I didn't really want to, but I was told to start giving talks, and I realized how difficult it was for me, and all these years of having this repertoire of brilliant talks in my mind, and, you know, I realized that I didn't have much ability, and it was very hard, and so I pulled the rug from underneath a certain kind of conceit that I had. This idea of the conceit of being a good Zen student was operating for me, wanting to be a good, outstanding Zen student. And it took various forms, all of them which were painful. And that's one of the clues we can have that conceit is not a helpful thing to have, because it can be quite painful. One of them was the idea of, in the Zen tradition, sometimes we would have these late night sits. We have this, in the retreats, we'd have this regular schedule, and it would end at 9:30 or so, and then there'd be this optional sitting afterwards. The optional sitting wasn't really optional, but it was just labeled optional. In Zen, it was very strange. In the Japanese Zen world, there's all these euphemisms, all these words that don't really mean what they mean, but you have to kind of be in the environment to know they mean something different. Like in the monastery, you're not supposed to, as Zen students, never supposed to have time off, like free time. That's just not, you know, it's not really, you're not really a serious Zen student. So you have personal room cleaning time. And that's your free time. There probably is some cleaning that goes on, but. Or going back to the Indian tradition, in Zen, in Buddhism, monks are not supposed to eat after 12 o'clock. So in the Zen tradition, they get around that. They eat after 12 o'clock, they have supper, but it's called a medicine meal because you're allowed certain medicine. Or in the monastery in Japan I lived in, there was the monastery layout is supposed to be, monasteries are supposed to be laid out in a particular way, geographically. But this one monastery I stayed in, it was all wrong because it was on the north side of the mountain rather than the south side of the mountain, so everything was turned around. So one of the rooms in the monastery was called the East Wing. There was East Wing and the West Wing. But in that monastery, because it was all turned around, what was called the East Wing was in the West Wing. It was in the West. Why am I saying all this? So the optional late night sit, you know, was optional. But actually, it wasn't. And so but the thing about the optional sitting is you can go to bed whenever you wanted to. It's up to you. It's self-regulating. So you could actually, you know, after 5 minutes get up and go to bed. But, you know, I wanted to be a good, you know, outstanding Zen student. So I'd be sitting there. And then my eyes would glance to the side to see who else was sitting up. Oh, I can't go to bed before him. Not before her, you know. Oh, she's not really sitting. You know, I know her. That's not real Zazen. That's not real meditation. Go to bed, so I can go to bed. You know, who wasn't really sitting was the question, right? So here this conceit, you know, with operating, about comparing myself to others and wanting to look good and painful, right? And then one of my first sesshins, or maybe second, these 7-day retreats they do in Zen, was at Green Gulch up in Marin County. And they had a custom there during that time that the last sitting of the evening, we would sit until the abbot would come in and say something very Zen-ish, poetic Zen-ish kind of thing. Often you read a poem or make up a poem. And it was very, very beautiful and inspiring. And so usually the sittings were 40 minutes long. And so usually he would come on time. But there was once where I think he was doing an interview that went on and on and on. And so the sitting didn't end. And so we were sitting there. And we're sitting there, and we're sitting there. You're not supposed to move in the Zendo, especially if you're supposed to be if you want to look good as a Zen student. But you're not supposed to. So you're sitting there and sitting and sitting there, and he wasn't coming, and he wasn't coming, and wasn't coming. And I was just racked in physical pain. And I was sitting. Where I was sitting was right in front of the door, where the abbot would come in. And at some point, I just collapsed. It's the most un-Zen-like way. I couldn't maintain it anymore. And at that very moment, the door opened. And who should walk in but the abbot, seeing me in the most un-Zen-like way. So there was a lot of conceit that was triggered and all kinds of things. I actually went to my room after that and cried. It was so painful, that whole event. An important aspect of my early years of practice was the times I often had a kind of a, in spite of sometimes thinking I was great, I often had a strong sense of being inadequate. Sometimes these things go hand in hand, right? But feeling inadequacy or not really feeling that I was very competent or doing well. And it was actually very important for me that my teachers would often encourage me. And actually they would mirror to me at times that I was doing quite well. And getting that kind of encouragement actually had a big impact on me and kind of begin to soften or relax or dissolve a sense of inadequacy or incompetency that I had. The Zen training often involves a lot of different activities. And some of the activities would require us to kind of raise to the occasion. So for example, I never really cooked before and I was put in the kitchen, or I was made kitchen manager and then supervising a whole bunch of people. And so I had to kind of raise to the occasion and take certain authority or take a certain competency in order to accomplish that job. And in the kitchen, it was very difficult for me because, as a kitchen manager, because it was a very stressful place to work. There's a lot of intensity in the monastic kitchen, and you're supervising a big crew of people. And in a monastic environment, people's egos get very, very sensitive. I remember once telling someone that she needed to cut the cucumbers a little bit smaller because they had to be smaller to fit into these little bowls that they're eaten out of. And she broke into tears because, she wasn't doing it right, the cucumbers. So so it was a very sensitive environment. And one of the things that I became painfully aware of as a kitchen manager was how much I wanted to be liked. So much so I would call it a neurotic tendency. At all expenses, I wanted to be liked by the people there. So I would go into these kind of amazing social gymnastics to try to say things to people so that what I felt needs to be said to get the job done, so they'd still like me after I said it. And boy, was that cumbersome. And I eventually, because it was so cumbersome to do that, I got to see this tendency, wow, I really always want to be liked. What's that about? And eventually I learned that to let go of that. I didn't have to be burdened by the idea that everyone's supposed to like me. I mean, in principle, it's a nice thing to have people like you, be a likable person. But to kind of be neurotic about it and kind of contort ourselves in all kinds of ways so people will like us, I think is really diminishes us as a person. So I think a certain level of maturity involves not being so concerned whether people like you or don't like you, to have the ability to feel at ease or peaceful when someone doesn't like us. So it certainly happened in that kitchen that there were times people were angry with me. In fact, I don't know if this is to the point exactly what I'm saying, but at one point one of the people who worked under me pulled me aside, took me outside, and I want to talk to you outside. He said, "Gil, if you weren't so sincere, I'd punch you out." So to be liberated from wanting people to like you. And then, you know, in Vajrayana practice, in Tibetan Buddhist practice, there's practices where people visualize themselves as a certain kind of deities. And some of these deities have a lot of very positive qualities of strength or of compassion or of regality, of kind of being kingly or being kind of the lord of the universe. And psychologically, at least kind of into a Western interpretation, psychologically this is very helpful sometimes to help shed some of the ways in which might feel the conceit of inferiority, the conceit of being inadequate or shy or being an unworthy person, to actually take time visualizing, imagining, and feeling yourself as being someone who's actually quite worthy and great. So we didn't do that in Zen practice, but we would sometimes some of the activities would actually call forth a certain level of strength and presence. Sometimes chanting would do that. We do a lot of chanting. And sometimes we would chant, you'd be the person who led the chanting. And yet in front of, you know, a room of 60 people, you had to lead, you know, do the kind of solo piece of the chanting. And you're supposed to do it with, you know, certain kind of vigor and strength. And I found it actually quite something day after day to do this kind of chanting, and actually it kind of changed my sense of who I was. At least during the time I was chanting, it kind of loosened up some of the stuck ways in which I was thought who I was or how I was supposed to be in the world. And often, I think we're often stuck. We often kind of develop a certain self-concept of who we are. And then we're stuck with that for maybe sometimes a whole lifetime. And it's great to do varied activities that break the crust of that mold that we're stuck in. And so I found that the Zen training was a great way to do that. Another thing that happened in the Zen training in the monastery was our jobs would change often. Sometimes every 3 months or 6 months or once a year, we'd get totally new jobs. And you know, you have more career, if you stay long enough in a monastery, you have more careers there than you'd have in a normal lifetime, or maybe you have one or two careers or something. And each different career in the monastery, every new job required a different way of being, a different kind of self, a different kind of way of relating to the situation. And it helped me kind of break the mold of kind of the old way I had, this is who I am, this is how I have to be. Sometimes the Zen training, Buddhist training, was actually quite difficult for me. It required a lot. It was hard work. It took a lot of determination, took a lot of courage, a lot of patience. So there's a tremendous difficulty. And hanging in there and seeing it to the end, to the other side, was very helpful for me, because it gave a sense of appreciating my capacity and develop some kind of strength in that working through difficult, hard things. Sometimes if you go to Spirit Rock, where I teach, that opportunity to develop in strength or confidence in oneself but going through difficult things is not supported so well by the structure of the institution. Because it's so easy at Spirit Rock, those retreats, to, if things get difficult, to just go for a walk or go take a bath or, you know, take a nap. In Zen training, you don't do that. I mean, you have to follow this very strict schedule, and when it's time to sit, you sit, when it's time to walk, you walk, and there's no variation to it. In fact, the first time I slept in by accident in the Zen monastery, Tassajara, I slept in a teeny bit, and so I came too late to get to the early morning meditation session. The door was closed, so I went back to my room to wait for the next chance to enter. I was convinced that later in the day I was going to be pulled aside and that they would tell me I had to leave the monastery. That was it. I'd blown it. And the amazing thing was, no one ever said anything. That was pretty amazing to me. I thought I just, you know, made this biggest faux pas in the monastery. It's like no one noticed. But anyway, because in Zen there's very little chance to vary from the schedule, you have to kind of either leave the monastery or hang in there through the difficult times. And I found it, for me personally, very helpful to do something that was very difficult and very demanding. One of the principles of this Zen training is that you would periodically go for interviews with a teacher. And one of the teachings, or one of the ideas of these interviews is, I mean, certainly you can go there for advice and all that, but one of the ideas is that the interview is actually a very special time where the student and the teacher are supposed to meet as each of them as Buddhas. So like, you're already a Buddha. What is it like to meet someone not as someone who needs help, but actually what is it like to meet someone as if you're already complete or perfect, or, and that person is complete and perfect, that person is a Buddha. So what does it take in the student to raise to the occasion to meet that teacher and be met as someone who are equals at that kind of level? And I found it a wonderful training to go into these interviews and find out, to experiment or to explore, what is it like to present myself or to be not someone who has a problems and needs help, which sometimes I would go with problems and wanting help, but actually come with a very different agenda. What is it like to meet this person as if I'm already complete? And there was one teacher in particular who I had a lot of projection or transference, kind of like father-like transference towards. I was very inhibited around this teacher because he was a great authority and very smart and the various kind of things that catch me. And I felt very kind of inferior and kind of inhibited, intimidated in his presence. And for about a year, I made it my practice to try to, all kinds of settings where I encounter this teacher, not just in formal interview, to try to work with this sense of inferiority I had and see if I could meet this teacher as an equal. What would it take? How to deal with that fear and all that. And it was great work. And after about a year, at some point, I realized that it takes two people to be able to meet as equals. And he didn't have the ability. And I felt like I'd gotten the benefit of working with him. Thank you. But it was a waste of my time to keep making the effort, because it was never going to happen. So I was content enough to stop working with that teacher. But even the effort sometimes to try to meet as equals can be kind of a lot of a burden, can cause a lot of suffering. And sometimes it's beneficial to make that effort, and sometimes to try to prove ourselves, I'm the same as you, and then kind of raising to the occasion or trying to manipulate people to see ourselves or try to act in certain ways or accomplish certain things to be equal is also can be a tremendous source of suffering and problems, and people can spend many, many years trying to prove that they're equal to their father or their mother or a sibling or a friend or something. And in doing that, we're not living our own lives, we're living someone else's life in a sense. a moment that was very important for me was, again, it wasn't in meditation, but it was on a meditation retreat. My first Vipassana retreat in Thailand. I showed up to the monastery and I was given a small meditation hut at the edge of the monastery, above a swamp, and a little hut on stilts. And I was told to just stay there and all day long to do my sitting and walking meditation. And once a day come for an interview, but otherwise not talk to anybody. And very quickly I realized that in all my years of Zen training, I'd always done it together in a group. And I'd gotten a lot of group support. It was wonderful to have that group support that made it possible for me to kind of be serious in practice and follow through on my intention to practice, because the group momentum was there to keep me going. But I'd never practiced alone. And here I was left alone in this little hut. And I realized that now it was time for me to learn the motivation inside of myself, the resolve or the motivation that would keep me going without other people watching or the group support, the momentum of other people doing the same thing, but completely, you know, rely on myself to kind of maintain the persistence. So I had to rise, I had to kind of develop something inside of me, a certain kind of strength. And that was a great training for me, to develop that strength to kind of, you know, do it without the support of others. And then at one point, because I'm kind of a person, was a person who kind of thought the rules and doing it right was so important and had to kind of follow the rules. And the basic idea of the monastery, the rule was, I was supposed to just do sitting and walking meditation all day, except when I went to meal or went for my interview. And then one day, for reasons I don't remember anymore, I did something which was very unusual. I took a break. And I took a little break for a few minutes to walk around the monastery. So I was walking around the monastery a little bit. And lo and behold, who else is walking around the monastery? The abbot. And, oh no, you know, I'm breaking the rules, I've been busted. You know, I'm not a serious student, you know, I'm just kind of loitering around. And, but the amazing thing was to me, was that when he saw me from a distance, he was maybe, I don't know, 50 feet away, he really saw me. You know, he, you know, turned, looked at me. But the way he looked at me, or the way I interpreted he looked at me, is that I felt like I was completely seen, and also at the same time seen right through. Not like he saw into my psyche, but kind of saw through like I was a tree. And there was no judgment whatsoever. There was no judgment, oh, Gil's supposed to be following the schedule and meditating. He's supposed to be a certain way. I was just being seen without any judgment. I didn't have to be anything in his eyes. I didn't have to, it was not measuring me through any kind of standards of good and bad, right or wrong. I was just being seen as a human being, just like you'd see a tree is there as a human being. And I felt like I was being seen for who I was. Or I felt that I was being seen in a liberated way. And it was really great for me to feel like I was being seen that way, because then it made it possible for me to see myself that way, without any kind of judgment, without any kind of, throughout the filters of right and wrong, good and bad. It's so fascinating. So, so in that glance, I thought I was being seen without any judgment. It showed me the possibility. It showed me the possibility of. not playing any of the conceit games, not playing game of thinking myself inferior, not playing the game or inadequate, not playing the game that I'm superior, better, and but also not needing to play the game of thinking that I'm equal or trying to prove that I'm equal. It's possible not just play the game. So all these things that I've described in my own practice life were very important moments, or very important parts of the training. And there I could give you many, many, many stories like this. And slowly over the years they kind of chisel away at some of the hard edges, or chisel away at some of the places where I'm stuck, or we're stuck with my identity. And whereas sometimes we like the story that Buddhist transformation happens in the Big Bang theory of enlightenment, right? That if I just do it right, then there's a this magic moment comes, this key, and then it's going to be all better from there on. And certainly there are very dramatic moments that can be transformative in practice, but there's also a lot to be said about how practice transforms us slowly. Just through small little steps. And so I can give you a lot of little steps, stories, a lot of little steps where my conceit of the three forms of conceit were slowly kind of chiseled away at. It became less and less operating for me. I certainly hope that you don't think that my talking on and on about myself here today is just another form of conceit. all this chiseling away, step by step. So all this happened without, you know, meditation. So what's the role? So maybe I didn't need meditation, right? I think that a lot of our growth happens in the experience of daily life. And I spent so much time in monasteries that, you know, my stories come from there. And I'm sure that many of you can tell stories, similar stories, at work or at home or in your communities or friends or whatever, where there's ways in which your conceit was somehow understood or challenged. But the advantage for me of meditation in this regard was that every day, sometimes many times a day, I would sit and meditate. And meditation is kind of like a lubricant. It lubricates the wheels so that these wheels can move more smoothly. They're not stuck. So often when we have a self-identity that's really stuck, you know, it's frozen. It doesn't move. And so when it doesn't move, then it's quite fragile, actually. And but when the whole operation of self is fluid, then we're not going to be stuck in some kind of self-identity. And so meditation is a lubricant. And so sitting in meditation, the ways in which I was stuck, the ways I was attached, preoccupied, ways in which often my sense of self was connected to fear. So my fear would dissolve, my stuckness would dissolve, you know, a little bit to some degree in the meditation. And so it'd be kind of like I'd come in and out of this place where I'd relax, unwind, dissolve, let go, dissolve the fear. And then I go back into the world where those start up again. And then I go back into meditation. Back and forth and back. It's like a massage, this rhythm of back and forth. And that rhythm, I think, made it possible, made it easier for me to learn these lessons from my daily life. Made me more fluid, made me more open to the possibility of being transformed by them, changed by them, or learned from them, or let go. So as I learned to let go more in daily life, it's because I learned to let go better and better in meditation. Meditation taught me a sense, or showed me a sense of well-being or peace that is independent of the conceit game, independent of who I am in relationship to others. And so when I started having a sense of that sense of, when I started having a sense of an independent a well-being that's independent of others, then I wasn't so fragile in relation to how other people see me or how I want other people to see me. And for many people, their sense of self, their self-identity, who they see themselves and how they represent themselves to others, has a lot to do with who we are in relationship. There's a relational self. And many of our roles as self are relational. Like I'm a father, someone's a mother, or a husband, or a wife, or a son, or a daughter, or the professional roles. I'm a doctor, or a nurse, or whatever. And those roles are relational roles. And so if our sense of self is tied up to those roles, then those roles don't really exist independent of how other people see us and how we interact with other people. And people who are stuck in a certain role will sometimes very neurotically go around and try to tell people, I'm really a doctor. You know, you go to some circumstance and where it has nothing to do with you being a doctor at all. But you have to somehow drop it in the conversation, you know, I'm a doctor. Just so people know who you really are. And so it's relational. You're trying to establish a sense of self that's relational. So I think a lot of the ways people suffer around a sense of self is relational. And they have a relational self that they're building up. What meditation can teach us, and there's other ways also, but one of the things meditation can teach us is that there's a sense of self which is independent from relationships. The independent sense of self. A non-relational sense of self. If a person has no experience of a non-relational sense of self, then they're going to think that the only game in town is the relational game. And they're going to put a lot of effort into establishing the right relationships, getting them all right, and be preoccupied by that. But if you realize that there's an independent self, or independent sense of freedom and peace, it's not relational, then you don't put all your eggs in the relational basket. Or you can hold the relational self lighter, easier, without so much desperation or without so much consequence or meaning that, you know, everything depends on that. The relational self is important, but you can hold it lightly. And you have a refuge, you have a place of safety or well-being that you know that is there independent of what happens in the relational world. Whether people like you or they don't like you, whether people judge you or don't judge you, then you have a sense of well-being. Sometimes I've had people talk to me about how they're so concerned by how people are judging them. They assume that people are judging. That's sort of neurosis. They're kind of worried and afraid people are judging. And it was really transformative to them to realize that maybe people aren't so concerned about them. But they're always judging them, strangers and everything. So that's great, I was happy for them. But then I sometimes will ask them one step further, and I say, well, that's fine. You know, I have some ease around this whole thing, with this judgment thing. But I bet there are people who are judging you. You know, it's unreasonable to assume no one's going to judge you. People do, you know, it's kind of like what people do often. So? Can you find a greater sense of strength or a greater sense of freedom and peace that where your freedom and peace is not dependent on whether or not people judge? Even if people do judge you, can you find your peace and freedom, your well-being? So... So my hope is that this talk today has given you some ideas of what you can investigate in your life, maybe even what you can let go of in your life, so that you can begin letting go of the conceit game for those of you for whom this is relevant. And the rest of you, thank you very much.